Funding for WBUR comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
You're listening to WBUR's special coverage of the U.S. Senate race in Massachusetts. I'm Bob Oakes. We here in the WBUR newsroom have spent the last 3 months or so on the campaign trail with each of the four Democratic candidates and the two Republicans. We're taking this hour to share with you in greater depth what we've observed about these candidates, both their political positions and their personal character. And we're drawing on one of the best assets at WBUR, our reporters. Five of them have followed the candidates closely. We begin with Massachusetts Attorney General Martha Coakley. WBUR's Monica Brady-Meyerov has been observing her closely. Monica's in the studio with us now. Hi.
Hi, Bob.
Monica, Coakley was the first to announce her intention to run for Senator Kennedy's seat and initially had the greatest name recognition. She goes into tomorrow still leading in the polls. What's she been doing in the final days of the campaign?
Well, she's been swinging around the state, collecting more endorsements from mayors and other lawmakers. She met with volunteers, told them to keep up the pace because the race is not won yet. And she's always reminding people to vote tomorrow at least once. That's been a joke she's used a couple times. But aside from greeting commuters at the subway today, she hasn't reached out much to undecided voters. Most of the people at her events are already in her camp, but she's very upbeat and confident.
Take us back in time. What have been the highlights of the Coakley campaign from your point of view?
Bob, Coakley's enjoyed her front-runner status, really playing it safe and running a pretty conservative campaign. Her most daring move was when she was the first to come out and say she wouldn't vote for the universal health care bill the House passed because it contained a provision restricting access to abortions.
I interviewed her at a campaign stop in Worcester the day she said that.
I think that it is unacceptable to say that the only way that we can get health care reform is to now hobble further constitutional rights of women who are guaranteed under Roe versus Wade and under our Constitution to access to reproductive choice.
Bob, if you remember at that time, the other three candidates expressed their approval of the health care bill, and she was the lone dissenting voice. Congressman Capuano, who voted for the bill in Washington, criticized her, and it really looked like this was going to become a wedge issue. But the next day, Capuano changed his mind, said that if this abortion provision was in the final bill and he was in the Senate, he wouldn't vote for it either. So I think this move may have won over some voters for Coakley because she made such a strong stand for women's reproductive rights. In one of the debates, Coakley even used it to make a very powerful point.
Steve, it's personal with me, and it's personal with every woman who's in this, who's watching this.
Monica, as the only woman in the campaign, it's personal to her in a way that's different for the three Democratic men. How has she used or not used her gender in this race?
Well, she said many times she's not using her gender to win votes. She just happens to be the only woman in this election. But she's already broken several gender barriers.
Right. She was the first female district attorney in Middlesex County, the state's first female attorney general, and, of course, she would be if she's elected the first female U.S. senator.
And whether she says it or not, her gender is attracting support. One of her most powerful fundraising tools is her gender. She's been on the national political organization Emily's List homepage for the last 3 months with a plea for donations. But here's the caveat, Bob. What I hear a lot on the trail from voters is that when they say they'll vote for Coakley, they say it might be an uninformed vote. They don't know much about her except that she's a woman and it would be a good thing to send a woman to the Senate and that she has favorable name recognition. But they can't say much about her qualifications.
Well, we mentioned that she is the attorney general and used to be the district attorney, and she is running on a very long record. I know that you've been looking critically at that record. What stands out?
Well, a few things have drawn some negative attention for Coakley. First, the Big Dig. She settled a criminal and civil lawsuit with the project managers of the Big Dig, and she was able to win $458 million for the state. But some say if she'd taken the company to trial, we would have learned a lot more about the management of the Big Dig and the problems with that project.
On the other hand, her defenders also say she saved the state money by not letting this case drag out in the courts.
That's right, Bob.
And Coakley was the district attorney when there was a slew of child abuse sex cases involving priests. She convicted Paul Shanley and John Gagan, and she's been criticized.
Well, overall, she has received praise for the way she handled the clergy sexual abuse cases. But in one case, some critics say she missed a big opportunity to nab Gagan earlier, and that was back in 1995 when the mother of three brothers alleged abuse at the hands of Gagan, and Coakley looked into it and cut a settlement deal that was secret, and she didn't go to trial. Well, she says she didn't have enough to charge and convict, but bishopsaccountability.org, which compiles a lot of church documents about this, says that Coakley just didn't look hard enough, that she never asked the archdiocese for Gagan's records, and those records stretch back decades and had many accusations of abuse. And Coakley defends the settlement because she says she didn't know that Gagan was a serial abuser.
But see, we didn't know that, and there was no way for us to know that, either from the church or from Boston. That would have also been irrelevant to these charges. What was most important and what we accomplished was taking Father Gagan out of commission.
Monica, stepping back from start to finish in this campaign, how's it changed over time?
Well, it's interesting, Bob, because I've really seen her warm up over the last 5 days. Listeners will probably remember that for most of the campaign, she wasn't very visible, and sometimes she's awkward and stiff around real people. And I witnessed this firsthand when I spent the morning with her as she shadowed a home health aide helping a woman with multiple sclerosis. We were in her home, and listen to Coakley, Bob, as she talks to the woman with MS who's in a wheelchair.
As Attorney General, we've done a lot of work around, as Senator Kennedy did, you know, trying to make life fair as possible for everybody, including people who have disabilities.
In this campaign appearance, it sounds a little like she's short in the warm and fuzzy quotient.
Well, it wasn't a campaign appearance. It was in the woman's home. There were only a handful of people there. And that's the point, is that she seems to have trouble warming up to and connecting with people at times.
Throughout the campaign, it seemed to many people that she lacked a boldness associated with the late Senator Edward Kennedy. I asked her about that just last week.
I've been bold in going after predatory lenders in Goldman Sachs, the only attorney general in the country who's taken on Wall Street. I've been bold in looking at, you know, the healthcare issues here, going after big pharmaceutical companies and holding them accountable. You know, I've been bold in jumping into this race, not worrying about who else was going to run, but being convinced that I could take my message to the voters.
Coakley was bold in that she did get into this race early, some say too early. She declared right after Senator Kennedy died and didn't wait to see if any of his relatives would choose to enter the race, and there are clear signs she was mounting a campaign well before then. Is that likely to turn Democrats off, Monica?
I think it mattered more at the time than it does now. But of all three candidates, she's the only one who's rarely mentioned Senator Kennedy. All of the others talk about working with the senator, trying to imply that they are the rightful heir. Coakley doesn't do that. Coakley is running as Coakley.
So at this moment, this election seems to be Coakley's to lose. What's your sense from the campaign? How's it feeling?
They're feeling very confident. And I think they pulled a big rabbit out of the hat today with a recorded message from former President Bill Clinton that's going out to 500,000 primary voters across the state. They're hoping that'll sway more people in their favor.
WBUR's Monica Brady-Meyerov has been following the Martha Coakley for U.S. Senate campaign. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
It will be an interesting race. I think it'll be very close, but I'm still determining now who I'll vote for next week.
I was going to vote for Martha Coakley, but now I'm thinking of Capuano because he's more decisive.
And now on to the campaign of Democrat Congressman Michael Capuano. WBUR's Bianca Vasquez-Tonis has been following the congressman. Hi, Bianca.
Hi, Bob.
What's he been doing the last few days of the campaign?
Well, Capuano must have attended at least a dozen holiday parties around Boston for different nonprofits and unions. Yesterday, he was in southeastern Massachusetts and on his home turf in Somerville. Definitely the biggest challenge for Capuano during this campaign is getting his name out there. He's known in Somerville, Boston, and Cambridge, the places he's represented for years. But he wasn't a statewide name like Martha Coakley.
So do us a favor then and sum up the Capuano pitch.
Capuano wants to be known as the guy who's going to most closely represent the interests of Ted Kennedy, or be the closest substitute for Ted Kennedy. He says the other candidates might have some of the same political leanings as Kennedy, but they don't have the same professional experience. Listen to how he talks about the other opponents in this race.
The other three candidates, though they seem to be fine people, have no experience in any legislative body, not the House, not the legislature, not the city council, not the PTA, not the Girl Scouts, for all I know. The Commonwealth of Massachusetts deserves somebody who knows how to get things done in Washington.
Capuano may want to be known as the guy who can get things done, who knows how to get things done, and who may be the closest thing we have running to Ted Kennedy, but a lot of people who watched and heard the debates that have been held between the Democrats have come away thinking of him as the angry candidate.
Bob, you're right. Capuano's biggest strength is also his biggest weakness. He's irreverent and he's passionate. And as you point out, that looks like anger to a lot of people. Some people hear a bully and others say, finally, someone is as outraged as I am. There's no doubt voters have a visceral response to Capuano.
And he's pretty unapologetic about his style.
That's for sure. But last week, I think for the first time, they're really trying to address this perception that Capuano is just a big hothead. Listen to this radio ad that Congressman Barney Frank did for Capuano. It started airing on Friday.
We need someone like him in the Senate, not just to vote right, but to be the kind of effective fighter that'll break through that logjam. I'll be honest with you, maybe more than you usually hear in a political ad, and say that I don't think I'd send him on a delicate diplomatic mission. But when it comes to somebody who's got the commitment and the knowledge to break that logjam that's bogged down so much important legislation in the Senate, Mike Capuano is the standout and stand-up guy.
So Barney says that Capuano will break through the logjams. Is that your impression? And I ask because during this campaign, I think we've gotten a pretty good sense of Capuano's voting record. He voted against the Iraq War and the Patriot Act. But do we know much about his ability to get consensus and organize colleagues?
I think you raise a good point. His colleagues in the House of Representatives, they say they consider him a real workhorse. Capuano is very close to the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, and she's tapped him to do a lot of very unpopular and hard tasks because, in her words, he's fair-minded and well-respected by his colleagues.
Well, what's that mean? What kind of assignments was he doing for Pelosi?
Well, the most significant was ethics reform. When Pelosi took over in the House, she promised to tackle what she called a culture of corruption. Good government activists on the outside were glad that Pelosi was taking this on, but they were perplexed by the choice of Capuano to do this because they didn't associate him with reform.
What did they associate him with then?
Taking special interest money. But Capuano won them over. They say he was pragmatic and he knew exactly how far he could push his colleagues. Listen to what Sarah Dufendock from Common Cause had to say about Capuano's work on ethics reform.
He absolutely believed in the mission that the speaker gave him. And because he wasn't seen as this, you know, fire-breathing reformer, he was able to get members on board with this change that I think, had it been someone else, would have been very, you know, a lot more skeptical of the solution.
So what came out of that? What did he end up doing?
Well, Capuano, along with his task force, they ended up creating an independent body made up of former members of Congress and prosecutors. It wasn't everything the activists wanted, but it was a major improvement. This is exactly how Capuano thinks change should happen, not in a radical way, but incrementally. But he still calls himself an idealist.
I hope I'm an idealist. I hope I'm a pragmatic idealist. And I know that sounds like an oxymoron, but it's not. A pragmatic idealist is somebody who wants to make the world perfect, but knows I can't. And you know, I want to work towards that, but I'm willing to accept small steps.
And it seems like Capuano got the reform bug after working on this. Now he's working on legislation with Common Cause to overhaul campaign finance laws.
Well, let's stay on that for a minute, campaign finance, because Capuano has been tied to the embattled lobbying firm called the PMA Group, now defunct. PMA is under investigation for possibly channeling illegal campaign contributions to key lawmakers on Capitol Hill. PMA was one of Capuano's largest donors. How's he reconcile that with wanting campaign finance reform now?
Well, first of all, Capuano hasn't been accused of any wrongdoing. He's donated all of the money he received through PMA to charity so that there's no perception of impropriety. But this is still tricky for Capuano. He argues that he hates fundraising because there's always the chance that someone giving him money is tainted. But he says it's a necessary evil given the financing system that we have. Here's how he defended himself to you, Bob, on our air a couple of weeks back.
I live in a two-family house in Somerville. Most of my friends are not multimillionaires. If I don't do this, then no working-class person can ever run for office. And if that's the goal that you want or anybody else wants, they need to say it. Working-class people need not apply. We only want multimillionaires in the Senate.
Capuano paints himself as the working class candidate, and yet he has disclosed that he's worth somewhere between $1.4 and $3.1 million.
That's right. Capuano would say his worth is based on the tremendous appreciation of the two-family house he bought in Somerville in the 1980s, along with some rental properties as well. But Capuano definitely identifies himself as working class, even though he's extremely well-educated. Those are his roots, and he talks about how when he was growing up in Somerville, all of his friends were raised by single moms at a time when women didn't have the right to alimony. He says everyone he knew was struggling to get by, and that formed his sort of populist sensibility.
When you grow up and you realize, you know, something, other places have things we don't have, other kids have more opportunities, why is that fair? You know, why should that be accepted in life? Why should I remain silent?
So, Bianca, do you think that Mike Capuano has been able to translate that working class identity into an identification with voters? It seems like a time when that message should translate, given that we're in the middle of this recession, these economic troubles.
I think that's a really good question, and I've heard some voters respond to his ability to relate to their financial worries and their questions, but I also think it's a place where his fiery persona just gets in the way for some voters. Still, I don't think anyone should underestimate Capuano. Some polls have put him in striking distance of Coakley, and this is how he won his elections for mayor and his seat in the U.S. House. He came from behind, and he beat the front runner, stunning everyone. He's a very strong campaigner.
WBUR's Bianca Vasquez-Tonis covering the Capuano campaign. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Bob.
Hopefully, these discussions are helpful for you, dear listeners, to get some clarity, because some people we've talked to on the streets are a little fuzzy.
There's Coakley and Capuano, and then there's I want to say his name is Karzai, but it's not that.
Andrew Karzai, right, and Martha Coakley. Who else? I'm trying to think of the other. Stephen, I don't remember his last name, but I'm still deciding who I'm going to vote for at this point.
I'm trying to think of Coakley. I can't think of the other two, but I really have no opinion.
You're listening to WBUR's special coverage of the Massachusetts U.S. Senate race. I'm Bob Oakes. We'll be back. Welcome back to WBUR's special coverage of the U.S. Senate race in Massachusetts. I'm Bob Oakes. And now on to another candidate. WBUR's Meghna Chakrabarty has been following businessman and Boston Celtics co-owner Stephen Pagliuca. And Meghna is in the studio now. Hello there.
Hi there, Bob. And I have to say, what a short, strange trip it's been so far.
How's Mr. Pagliuca spent the last few days of the primary campaign?
Well, this weekend he crisscrossed the state on what his campaign is calling a Jobs Express tour, and he released yet another television ad, but this one a mighty 2 minutes long.
And he has come some distance in this race, hasn't he?
He has. I mean, 11 weeks ago when he announced, unless you are a Celtics season tickets holder, which unfortunately isn't very many of us, most people were probably wondering, Pagliuca who? But now, after spending more than $5 million of his own money, including on those television ads, not only does he have some name recognition, but Steve Pagliuca is actually the one who's really shaking things up in the late stages of this race.
And we saw that late last week when Pagliuca attacked Coakley and Capuano for not being what he called reliable votes on health care.
Exactly. Steve Pagliuca is a political novice, but he is a very quick study, and his campaign is also staffed by some skilled Massachusetts political hands.
Including Doug Rubin, who was a chief aide to candidate, and then Governor Deval Patrick.
Precisely, which is why when Mike Capuano and Martha Coakley said that they would not vote for a health care bill if it contained the Stupak Amendment, that's the one that you discussed with Monica, that would put further restrictions on federal funding for abortion, that was the first sliver of daylight differentiating these very closely aligned candidates. And when Pagliuca saw that, he absolutely bulldozed his way right through it, as we saw in last week's debate.
This is confusing the issue. No, it's not confusing the issue. This is death panels.
You're going to be the Sarah Palin of the Democratic Party.
Can I just say, Emily?
Death panels, Sarah Palin of the Democratic Party. I mean, those are liberal fighting words if I've ever heard them. And Bob, you were actually a panelist in that debate, and you were in the studio. Did you see that coming?
Well, yes and no, in that it didn't seem like Pagliuca was spoiling for a fight. But yes, on the other hand, in that he is down in the pack and he needed to do something to get some attention.
But the problem, of course, is that Mike Capuano is never afraid of a fight. And now he's painting Pagliuca as the man who would send women, quote, back to the alleys of America. So going hard and going negative might end up backfiring on Pagliuca.
Is he getting much bounce from these attacks and the money that he's invested in this campaign?
He's probably not. I mean, you can see that in events such as this past weekend on Sunday, where he campaigned in Harvard Square, but only 30 people showed up. They were all his campaign staffers, and not a single voter stopped by to find out a little bit more about who this guy is.
Some people think that it's a little surprising that Pagliuca is the one to shake things up in this campaign, considering that people who know him say that his temperament is actually very diplomatic.
And that is one of the most interesting things about Pagliuca, and it's something that voters might not actually know. I mean, yes, he's very rich. He's worth some $400 million. But when you meet him in person, you find that he's not an egomaniac. In fact, he's totally disarming. He's funny. Earnest, even.
We've talked about Pagliuca as being a political novice, never having run for any kind of office before. And in fact, when we first interviewed him back in September, the day after he announced, he was very green on foreign policy. Listen to how he sweats out an answer about President Obama's decision to scrap the missile defense in Europe.
The concern that I share is if we put the missile systems up in Europe, we are going to incite, bad relations with the rest of the other countries.
You can hear him sweat
rest of the
right
other countries.
Through the microphone. But he clearly learned his political lessons quickly. He's obviously a very ambitious person. He made millions at Bain Capital, the massive private equity company here in Boston.
Yes, he did. He's ambitious, he's aggressive in his decisions, and obviously very successful. I mean, he says his experience buying, selling, and funding companies through Bain is why he has dubbed himself the jobs candidate.
His jobs plan includes focusing on green industry, on clean industry, on biotech industry, Massachusetts strongholds. How's it going to work?
Well, what he wants is more funding for small businesses and promising startups, and more funding for job training. And he calls the federal government a critical partner in bringing those dollars to the table. He's also got an interesting, even unique stance in this race, particularly on financial regulation. Martha Coakley and Mike Capuano prefer state-level oversight through attorneys general. But Pagliuca told you, Bob, last month that the big investment houses on Wall Street can only be reined in by the long arm of the federal government.
Good businesses can play by the rules if they know what the rules are. It's as if business would say, well, we don't need referees for NBA games. You know, as soon as we took the referees out, even though many of us don't like the referees, me among them, but as soon as we took the referees out, there'd be mayhem out there. And that's what we've had on Wall Street. We've had mayhem because we didn't have a strong central referee.
Pagliuca may have the brains for business, but he also carries a lot of baggage because of his association with Bain Capital.
Yes,
right?
Yes, he does. And there's a lot to unpack in that baggage. I think it's one of the biggest reasons why some voters might still feel uncomfortable with the idea of Steve Pagliuca as senator.
So, Meghna, unpack some of that baggage for us. First off, the claim that he's a job creator.
Which is true in the case of some companies he's acquired, like the Gartner Group, but not true in other deals he's been part of, like KB Toys and Dade International. Both those companies ended up bankrupt and laying people off.
Okay, now another piece of baggage. At least among Massachusetts Democrats, his friendship and support of the man who hired him at Bain, well-known Republican, former Governor Mitt Romney.
Precisely, Bob, and I think this is one of the weightiest parts of that baggage. Steve Pagliuca's always called himself a progressive Democrat. He says his first political donation was to Bill Clinton. But soon after he made that donation to Clinton, he then donates money to Mitt Romney's 1994 Senate campaign against Ted Kennedy. I asked him about that a number of times, and every single time, Pagliuca says he actually does not see a conflict between loyalty and principle.
You know, I donated that money out of friendship. Mitt Romney hired me, and I worked with him for 15, 16 years, and this, for me, came out of friendship, not out of politics.
And he does stick to that, Bob. He says that those loyalties, those friendships, wouldn't get in the way if voters decide to send him to Washington.
All right, the primary is tomorrow. By the way, we'll be covering results live starting at 8 o'clock tomorrow night here on WBUR. Meghna, has Pagliuca been successful in his expensive effort to sell himself to voters?
Well, people I've spoken to on the campaign trail after meeting him in person, those folks say yes. But in such a short race, you're obviously not going to meet all that many voters in person. So Pagliuca's bigger worries may be all that baggage that he's carrying, as we talked about, and what effect going negative on Martha Coakley and Mike Capuano has had on his campaign.
And what about those people who say, and we've heard him say it, that Steve Pagliuca is too rich?
Well, I think for a lot of people, that is still a major issue. But it's not as if Massachusetts has always turned its back on well-heeled politicians. They made Mitt Romney governor, they continued to put John Kerry in Washington, and of course Massachusetts was very happy to have Ted Kennedy in the Senate for 47 years.
All with no shortage of green stuff in their wallets.
No shortage at all.
WBUR's Meghna Chakrabarty covering the Pagliuca campaign. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Bob.
And joining us now to talk about the fourth Democrat in the race, Alan Casey, is WBUR political reporter Fred Tice. Fred, thanks for coming in.
Hi, Bob.
So tell us what Casey has been up to in the final hours or the final days of the campaign.
So today he's been in western and central Massachusetts. He's been in Lenox, in Springfield, and in Worcester. He spent the weekend talking to voters in eastern Massachusetts. I was with him, for example, as he tried to win over voters at the Orchid Diner in New Bedford. He was able to engage with some people, and they promised that they'd vote for him. Others, Republicans, they told me afterwards, just thought he was bothering them.
As would any Democrat. When the race started, in the media, we were talking about which Kennedy and which members of Congress might jump into this race. And Alan Casey, his name really never came up. He was a surprise.
He was. He was the last one to jump into the pool. He announced his candidacy after the other three candidates were already in the race. He likes to say that he had more people at his announcement than anybody else, and he did. He launched his campaign on Boston Common. Casey quickly raised $1 million, though, in September, outraising everyone but Martha Coakley. So money was not an issue.
But he did make some rookie mistakes. What kind of rookie mistakes are we talking about?
Well, I'll give you one. At the first debate at the Kennedy Library, he stumbled on the issues. He said, for example, he was asked what he would do to keep military bases in Massachusetts, and he said he'd try to get a seat on the Armed Services Committee to save those bases. But the reality is that the whole system that the Pentagon set up for closing bases is designed to prevent congressional influence from affecting which bases get closed. So Casey showed that, at least at the outset, he did not have a good sense for how Congress works.
And then there's also this. Besides founding City Year, Casey is most proud of having saved AmeriCorps by getting people to descend on Washington to lobby Congress to restore money for the program. But as we heard in a recent story by WBUR's Deb Becker, not everyone agrees it was Casey who saved AmeriCorps.
Leslie Lankowski, in 2003, he was CEO of the Corporation for National and Community Service, which is the federal agency that oversees AmeriCorps. He says Casey's citizen hearing was helpful, but it wasn't the deciding factor in getting Congress to keep AmeriCorps funding and increase it by $100 million in the next year.
There's the sizzle and there's the steak. Alan and his colleagues had lots of sizzle, lots of visibility, lots of PR, and so on. But the actual problem was discovered by the Bush administration. The key proposal was made by the Bush administration. The deal that ultimately came out of it was negotiated before Alan got involved.
Casey, his supporters, and a former aide to President Bush all dispute Lankowski's point of view.
Fred, in the big picture, Alan Casey's campaign kind of shows us how hard it is for an unknown to mount a campaign, even when he's running against other relative unknowns, with the possible exception of the Attorney General Martha Coakley.
Yeah, you know, he's had a tough time breaking through. In the Boston Globe poll published 2 weeks ago, Casey was in fourth place. Now, here we are at the end of the race, and if you believe the polls, he has fewer people with him than any of the other three candidates. But, of course, the people who volunteer for Casey, who are knocking on doors, they look at those polls and they say, this is still a race that they can win, because at this late date, so many people are still undecided. I spent time with the Casey campaign on Thanksgiving weekend. I was knocking on they were knocking on doors. I was watching them knock on doors in Cambridge with Tony Mack, a professional grassroots organizer who was volunteering his time for Casey.
We're identifying supporters and we're doing persuasion. I mean, there's so many people who are undecided right now. I've never seen an election where you get this close to the election and most people seem to be undecided. I really felt like with a really good grassroots campaign, because so many people are undecided, he can definitely win.
The Casey campaign feels so familiar because it's so similar to the ones that Barack Obama and Deval Patrick ran, trying to tap into the grassroots. But Patrick and Obama ran at a time when the atmosphere was ripe for change. Is Casey finding that voters have kind of overloaded on change? He says he's a different kind of politician, but have voters overloaded on people claiming to be a different kind of politician?
Certainly the polls would indicate that Casey's message is not catching on with voters.
In the past, successful grassroots campaign have been coupled with a strong media campaign. The Obama campaign's a very good example of that. What's Casey been doing about that?
Well, he's been counting mainly on the grassroots, but early on we got a sign that the grassroots candidate could not even count on the grassroots to get himself on the ballot. Like all the candidates except for Martha Coakley, he had to pay to get enough signatures to get himself on the ballot.
What effect has the brevity of this race had on the Casey campaign?
In a sense, all four campaigns have been hobbled because all of them are trying to mount an effective get-out-the-vote effort. But Casey may be hampered the most of all because he seems to be the candidate counting the most on this get-out-the-vote effort. It's the kind of effort that takes a long time to organize. You have to identify your voters. Both Patrick and Obama had more than a year to put their primary campaigns together. This primary campaign has lasted 3 months. It began on Labor Day when Joe Kennedy announced he wouldn't run for his uncle's seat.
Which raises another question. The short race is an interesting test of what the grassroots can produce. Is there a weakness in a grassroots campaign by virtue of the fact that Casey is working with young people? Has he connected with people who are not activists? Has he connected to regular voters?
We had that moment in the last debate that where you were one of the people asking the questions Martha Coakley criticized Casey for taking money from Hollywood, and he had this comeback.
I plead guilty to getting money from Leonard Nimoy. I'm a Star Trek fan. You know, live long and prosper.
So it was funny, and I think Casey was making fun of his own wonkish image. As for focusing on young people, Casey's energizing young people to knock on doors for him. But they're focusing on getting the same voters that the other campaigns are trying to get out to vote. The super voters is what Matt O'Malley, who is Steve Pagliuca's field director, calls them. People who vote in every Democratic primary election. Those voters tend to be retired, and they're the ones being contacted by this campaign.
So does the Casey campaign have long to live? Is it going to prosper? Is he reaching the voters that he needs to reach?
Well, if the polls are any indication, what seems to be happening is that the Casey campaign workers are reaching the voters he needs to win over. Those are the older retired voters, the super voters. But Casey's message seems to have fallen flat on those voters. If the polls are right, contacting the voters is not enough. You need to actually win them over.
Well, we'll see how many voters Alan Casey has won over. When the votes are counted on Tuesday night, we'll have live coverage of the results starting at 8 o'clock tomorrow night. WBUR's Fred Tice, thanks a lot for coming in now.
And looking forward to talking to you tomorrow.
An underlying theme of this race has been the lack of excitement. And when we went out on the street, it seems that you potential voters weren't feeling too jazzed either.
I suppose I've been attracted to some of the positions that Mr. Capuano, I'm not even sure I'm saying his name correctly, but the congressman has expressed in the last couple of days. But apart from that, I have no strong preference. Unless I hear something to the contrary, I probably will wind up voting for Coakley because she has the most visibility.
They're a bunch of unique candidates, for sure. But as far as their positions and how they'll represent me and my family and my district and what's important to me, I really can't say.
I don't think any of them really is very unique. They're almost the same to me.
This is Bob Oakes. You're listening to WBUR's special coverage of the Senate race wrapping up with a primary election tomorrow. We'll be back. The four Democrats are not the only candidates vying for a spot on the final ballot in January. Two Republicans, Rentham State Senator Scott Brown and Duxbury businessman Jack E. Robinson, are running for their party's nomination. Both of them squared off in their only televised debate today at Channel 2. WBUR's Steve Brown has been keeping an eye on the GOP race and joins us now. Hello, Steve.
Hi, Bob.
We haven't really heard as much from the Republicans as we have from the Democrats, have we?
No, we haven't. This has sort of been a stealth campaign for the Republicans. It looked like for much of September and October that there wouldn't be a contest. Scott Brown announced way back in September that he was running after several other party A-listers, including White House, former White House Chief of Staff Andy Card, said that they would not run. It wasn't until the first Democratic debate over at the Kennedy Library when Jackie Robinson, who's become a perennial candidate here in Massachusetts, decided to get into the race. He paid about $100,000 to a firm to collect signatures, and he got himself on the ballot.
Did Robinson's entry into the race change the dynamics of the Republican campaign?
Well, as far as Scott Brown is concerned, it really hasn't at all. Brown has been running as if he is the presumptive nominee. His campaign has been cranking out responses, not to anything that Robinson says or does, but he's been responding to the issues that come up among the Democratic candidates. Both Brown and Robinson have been individually quietly making the rounds of various Republican and business gatherings around Massachusetts.
On the Democratic side, there have been several debates among the candidates, but until today, not so for Republicans.
That's right. It's pretty clear Scott Brown doesn't want to debate Jackie Robinson. Not out of fear that he's going to lose the debate, but I think he's figured out that he's got nothing to gain by a debate.
Let's talk about the candidates themselves. I had a chance to spend some time with Scott Brown, and I found him to be what I would call quietly confident, a quality you don't necessarily always find in a candidate. He certainly doesn't feel like you're a typically boastful politician.
No, he's low-key. Scott Brown is one of five Republicans in the state Senate. He's held that position since winning one of the closest special elections in state history 5 years ago. He's been endorsed by most of the party establishment here in Massachusetts. Mitt Romney even attended a fundraiser for him. He touts himself as an independent thinker.
If you want somebody who's not going to look, sound, and vote the same way, like we already have 11 people down there who do that, if you want somebody who's just a little different, who will pick up the phone and come and answer your questions personally, then, you know, vote for me. If you want somebody who's going to be the same old, then vote for the other people.
Brown's positions are consistent with Republican Party orthodoxy. He's for cutting spending, lowering taxes, and shrinking the size of government. He's a supporter of the military, and he's been a member of the National Guard for 30 years.
And what about Jackie Robinson?
Well, as I mentioned, Robinson has become a perennial candidate here in Massachusetts. This is his fourth run in 9 years. And like his other bids, this run is, for all intents and purposes, self-financed. He loaned this campaign $472,000, but he's only raised $4,000.
He's raised $4,000 for a U.S. Senate campaign.
That's right.
He's a lawyer and a businessman. Tell us a little bit more about his background.
Well, he's got an Ivy League education. He went to Brown University and both Harvard Law and Business Schools. He served as president of the now defunct Eastern Airlines, and he founded a cellular phone company in the Caribbean.
You know, I think we should remind listeners that at one time, Eastern Airlines was a very big deal in Boston. They were a big business. They had a huge terminal over at Logan Airport.
It's right. They had a huge terminal, and they were the Eastern Shuttle. That was the way to get from Boston to New York by air. This is before any of the other airlines got into that route.
Tell us more about Jack E.
He describes himself as a progressive Republican, but let's have him tell us about him.
I am a Teddy Roosevelt progressive Republican. I support equal rights for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender citizens. I also am in favor of making sure that we don't spend a lot of money unnecessarily. We have $10 trillion, $12 trillion of debt already, gone up to $20 trillion, $1.3 trillion deficit. We need someone who has the fiscal conservative background and the business background, as I do, to make sure we don't spend money unnecessarily.
Jackie Robinson hasn't had much success in his past bids for political office, and maybe that's an understatement. What makes him think he can win a U.S. Senate race?
Well, he's an optimist, although most political observers say that he's delusional. He points to one of his political mentors, former U.S. Senator Edward Brooke, and says that Brooke ran unsuccessfully for three offices before finally getting himself elected.
So, Steve Brown, we'll find out what tomorrow holds for Jackie Robinson and the other Republican in the race, State Senator Scott Brown.
That's right.
WBUR's Steve Brown, no relation. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Joining us now, as they have through the entire campaign, are our political analysts on the Democratic side, Dan Payne. Hello, Dan.
Hi, Bob.
And on the Republican side, Todd Domke. Hello, Todd.
Hello.
Pick up right where we left off, the Republican race. It's not really much of a contest, Todd.
No, that's right. And what often isn't reported is that Jackie Robinson is not taken seriously as a challenger, partly because as a perennial candidate, he sort of disgraced himself in the past. Scott Brown, though, is a solid candidate, a state senator from Wrentham. He's in the National Guard. He's an impressive guy.
Going back to the beginning on the Republican side, Dan, there was tremendous buzz for a while that some well-known Republicans would jump into the race, such as former Bush White House operative and Holbrook native Andy Card. And as Steve Brown mentioned a few minutes ago, they stayed out. Why did the well-known not opt in?
because it would have been impossible for them to win.
Okay, let's go to the Democrats. Big picture, Martha Coakley, consistent in her front-runner status from the start of this race, but the Capuano campaign insists that in recent days it's closing. Do you see it that way, Dan?
If turnout is light enough, Capuano could make it a race. But there doesn't seem to be any reason to doubt that Martha Coakley is ahead. The fact that former President Bill Clinton agreed to do a robocall for her suggests that they've got the momentum in this campaign.
That's right. That was a big coup. 500,000 voters will be receiving that robocall from Bill Clinton. And, you know, in a political campaign, you want to save the best for last, to finish strong, to inspire your own troops. So she is ending in a very strong way. Capuano, though, he never really had a clear message strategy. He kind of kept test driving issues, and when they didn't click, he'd move on. So yes, he'll do well in his own congressional district, but he really hasn't inspired a great many voters outside his CD.
We've speculated in this race and heard anecdotally that the temperament issue might have cost Capuano some support. But there will be people out there who will love that style. So balance it out, Todd. Does the issue of his temperament help him or hurt him?
Well, there's a line between being feisty and then being overly aggressive to where it backfires. He was self-destructive in those final debates, and I think that'll be remembered as the pivotal reason he lost, because he seemed resentful of the other candidates and really quite unwilling to engage in debate with the front runner, Martha Coakley, and instead he got into these squabbles with the lesser candidates.
Well, nevertheless, he did put together a pretty good group of endorsers.
But not the Kennedy family, which he had hoped to get.
No, the Kennedy endorsement was the thing he had hoped most for. Joe Kennedy Jr. or perhaps even Vicky Kennedy got neither one of them. But I think, as Todd said, his temperament was the problem.
So chance or no chance tomorrow?
Chance.
Okay. Alan Kazee, City Year co-founder. Many people thought that Alan Kazee had the most potential as a successful candidate. Has he lived up to that potential, Todd? And if not, why not?
No, he hasn't. His big credential was the idea of volunteerism. Now, he could have made that out to be a new force in American politics, an alternative to the two parties, but he didn't. Instead, he just gave us the usual liberal rhetoric, and so he didn't turn on the independents he needed to come into the Democratic primary.
Well, Alan Kazee was never in it because he had no recognition and too little money, but most important of all, he had too little time. In order to do the kind of campaign that he wanted to run, the grassroots door-to-door campaign requires months, in some cases years, to do. You can't do it in 10 weeks.
Let's move on to the fourth Democrat. Businessman, entrepreneur Steve Pagliuca purchased some name recognition with his huge TV ad buy. What else do you think it got him?
His buys, his TV buys, were so suffocating. It really became almost a joke that he was everywhere. And I don't think he had a unique enough message to justify his omnipresence in this campaign through broadcast media.
In terms of the media commissions going to his handlers, you can understand their enthusiasm for him. They made a lot of money off him. But they didn't handle him well. They really should have given him positioning more to the conservative side to appeal to the one-third of conservative Democrats.
Back to the big picture. In this race, is there a motivating issue for voters, or is this, especially in this short campaign, all about voting for the candidate I feel most comfortable with?
Well, the four candidates are ideologically monochromatic, so it really became a race about nothing. Voters were asking themselves, well, if they're all the same, well, why don't I vote for the one I like? Or in this case, why don't I vote for the woman? Had Barney Frank or Ed Markey been in the campaign, it might have been very different. Might have been different if we had a conservative candidate in the field.
Okay, the end tomorrow. Todd Domke, the Republican, will be?
It'll be Scott Brown, and he should win by something like 80%.
And the Democrat will be?
I think it'll be Coakley, comfortably, around 40%.
Okay, Dan Payne, the Democrat, will be?
Martha Coakley. You know, she'll have perhaps a margin of 9-10 points.
And the Republican?
It'll be downtown Scotty Brown, as they used to call him on the high school basketball court.
Dan Payne, Todd Domke, thanks a lot.
Good to be with you.
You're welcome.
Alan Kazee?
Alan Kazee.
Alan Kazee?
Alan Kazee, I'm not sure of the pronunciation, but I know Stephen Pagliuca.
Pagliuca. Pagliuca.
Stephen Pagliuca. Pagliuca.
Stephen Pagliuca. No, Pagliuca. Yeah.
Stephen Pagliuca. No, I don't even know. That was way wrong.
We've been teasing you with these mispronunciations and others the whole hour, but now, as is our mission, we set the record straight with our senior web producer and pronunciation stickler, Andrew Phelps. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Bob. We radio people care a lot about pronunciations. You actually tried to set the record straight with a certain Democratic congressman from Somerville, Michael...
Depends who you're talking to. People who speak Italian would say my name, Michele Capuano. But most people anglicize most things, so my name would be Michael Capuano. My middle name is Everett, so it's Michael Everett Capuano or Michael Everett Capuano, and it doesn't matter to me. It's all respectful, and as long as you put an X next to it, I'm a happy guy.
Well, shake my hand and introduce yourself.
Depends who you are. Where are we?
We're...
You're Bob Oak, so it'd be Mike Capuano.
Well, Bob, nice to know he shares the same confusion.
And just don't call him Everett. Andrew, you set the record straight with the co-owner of the Boston Celtics, Stephen.
It's pronounced Pagliuca. The G is silent in Italy, like lasagna.
Like lasagna. So Pagliuca, like lasagna. Yeah. Might that be a campaign slogan?
I don't know. We'll have to pass it by the creative ad people, but it's really more Pagliuca like jobs.
Pagliuca like jobs, a very similar pronunciation.
He probably should have tried your idea, Andrew. What about the Democrat who helped start City Year, Alan?
Bob, we've got this one covered. One of his TV ads nips this problem in the bud.
Hazy.
No, Casey.
Daisy.
No, Casey.
Jay-Z.
No, Casey.
Who's he?
Alan Casey. Not Hazy, Daisy, Jay-Z. He's Alan Casey.
Okay, we get it. Alan Jay-Z.
No, Casey.
Well, thankfully, the remaining Democrat has it pretty easy, Martha Coakley. And on the Republican side, Scott Brown is pretty much no-brainer.
And that leaves one more candidate, a Republican, whose name causes confusion for other reasons, Jackie Robinson, or rather, Jack E. Robinson. The E is his middle initial.
All right, Andrew, thank you very much for the clarity. That's WBUR's Andrew R. Phelps, R for Richard.
Thank you, Bob.
Politics as usual.
Don't forget tomorrow's special coverage of the Senate primary. We'll have a comprehensive look at the candidates and their campaigns. Again, tomorrow night, complete election coverage with returns, candidate reports, and in-studio analysis here on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. And now this observation, if you'll permit me. It's as if we were just getting to know these candidates, and now the campaign is ending. The campaign, if we can call it that, is ending too soon, especially considering we're more used to the years-long marathons running up to presidential election day than we've been with this short, three-month-long affair. Martha, Mike, Alan, Steve, Scott, Jackie, we hardly knew you. At least that's true for all but the two of you who will be going forward to the final election in January. Should we read predictions of a low voter turnout as a signal of the fact that the campaign came at the time of year when we're most distracted, the holidays, or is it a lack of interest in these candidates? Is it a lack of confidence that over time, whichever one is elected won't develop into the next Ted Kennedy? After all, the bar is so high. President Obama described Kennedy as not only one of the greatest senators of our time, but one of the most accomplished Americans ever to serve our democracy. But you shouldn't allow the lack of current stature to keep you from taking an 11th-hour look at this field of candidates, because while they all have their peccadilloes, they also each show potential. Democrats, Attorney General Martha Coakley has been called colorless and icy, but she's as smart and sharp as any candidate you'll ever meet. The same could be said about the passion Congressman Mike Capuano shows about the issues he believes in, even though he's been labeled too hot temper-wise. Among the Democratic newcomers, City Year co-founder Alan Casey, who's been called wonkish, has a vision worth review. and businessman Steve Pagliuca, who's tossed oodles of his personal fortune around to buy name recognition, has buried himself in briefing papers to bone up on the issues, reminding us of the way Senator Kennedy used to educate himself. Even the overshadowed are worth a look, the GOPers. State Senator Scott Brown is coolly confident, and Republican Jackie Robinson did run a few successful businesses. Ducking out on voting tomorrow is the easy way to go. But considering the attention that Senator Kennedy drew to Massachusetts and the money and the jobs he brought here, and the fact that we'll be counting on this new senator to do the same as much as is possible for a Capitol Hill newcomer, ducking out is the wrong way to go. I'm Bob Oakes. Thanks for joining us.